Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Oh, I had an interesting interchange with a reporter from the San Francisco newspaper because he published an article and my hair stood up. I went on it and I couldn't believe what I read. The headline, I swear they dropped it. Oh, here it is. Wait, here's the headline. I'm trying to get it back up. They took down the original headline. The original headline says that although the coast of California is cooler and wetter, it proves that there's global warming. It showed that it proves that there's global warming. So in other words, even though it's cooler, they say this proves that it's global warming. So then they find some stupid moron meteorologist, in other words, a weatherman, a pothead weatherman who says, "Wait a minute," he says. The findings of it getting colder fit in with the predictions of Al Gore scientists who believe the climate is changing as a result of human-caused carbon emissions. So in other words, even though it's getting cooler, it's because of global warming. It's astounding how they get away with this. So I sent them an email. He sent me an email. I sent him an email. Back and forth, we had an email exchange, which is very interesting to see. And it's actually sad when you look at it. It's sad when you see he's probably a nice guy who writes for the newspaper, you know. And I sent them an email, and he sent me one. I sent them a Delling Poll's article, so he sends me one from someone who says that Delling Poll is a fool. So I send him an email, and I say, "The corrupt leading the dumb," is what I sent to him. "The corrupt leading the dumb." So he sends me an email which says, "Back to you," he says. "Back at you," he says. So I send him an email, and I say, to the reporter, "Your degree is in what, journalism?" I mean, he's writing about global warming. I said, "Your degree is in what, journalism?" So he sends me an email which says, "If you have a criticism, make it, please. I don't have time for games." Doesn't answer the question. So then he sends me another one, and I say to him, "Your degree is in what, please?" And then he says to me this, and I say to him, there's an interesting email I send him. I say to the reporter from the Chronicle who's pushing the global warming hysteria, I said, "I would refrain from disagreeing with a man of your scientific expertise, given you are so knowledgeable that you would hope to educate me and my millions of my listeners. May we request a live interview with you that you might dispense with the hundreds of scientific articles disproving Al Gore's faulty theory? P.S. Gore received a D in the one science course he took in college." And then he sent me an email back which said, I don't know what he said. And he said, "I'm not sending propaganda. I sent you a link that might help you educate yourself about the folks who disagree with you about climate science." He said, okay, so now you know what the whole journalist establishment is today. You could see what it is. It's very sad. It's extremely sad. They're probably nice people. And he says to me, finally, "I am neither a scientist nor am I a proponent of any view on the subject." Suddenly becomes Mr. Neutral. He said, "So I'm afraid I can't help you in the dispensing argument. But your sarcasm is so endearing, I suggest you get a scientist or the guy who made those videos I sent you to argue against your hundreds of articles and listeners. I think his name is," and he gives me a name. "He's well-spoken, easy to find, and would probably give you a good show." And that was the end of it. And I thought how sad the world is, that boys like this would go to school and get a degree in mass communications, come out and know nothing about science, and just be a useful tool of the international schemers who are making a fortune on carbon credits and such lies. They're not bad people, these reporters. They're not bad. I mean, my intent is not to ridicule them. It's just sad. And the same sadness overwhelms me when I see how Obama, the corrupt Obama, can manipulate these people. You see how he aged? By the way, you take a look at Obama. Man, that guy, he aged 10 years in the last few months. I don't know what it is. Maybe all the golf or something. There could be toxins in the golf course while he's aging. Let's hope not. I mean, something in the grass. Something. I don't know what it is. Bad diet? Something. Stress? He never thought it would be this hard? I mean, till now, the skids were greased by the controllers from the KG. But, everything was skidded and greased and go for nothing. The Punaho, and don't worry, we'll bury your records. And now, he's a guy. Look, you look at the history books, and you see when Hitler came to power, what they were saying with dictatorship. And I have to use the example, not because Obama's like Hitler, don't get me wrong, but listen. Here's what a dictator says. Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer, meaning one person, one people, one nation, one leader, right? Ein Volk, one people, ein Reich, I think, one nation, one government, and then ein ruler, one leader, one dictator. And then they were saying things like Hitler is Germany and Germany is Hitler. Hitler is Germany, Germany is Hitler. They're brainwashing the people into accepting the absolutism of Hitler. Now, you see the same thing today in Syria where Assad, the pinhead, and I use that phrase because he looks like that family always had a microcephalic look, incidentally. The man is machine gunning his own citizens in Syria and the world does nothing. Nothing. Zero. It's that Israel they talk about because a Palestinian broke a hangnail throwing hand grenades into a nursery. But here you've got Assad machine gunning his own people and the world does nothing. Admittedly, Turkey's massing troops on the border with Syria and they may invade because they're not going to sit idly by because they have blowback for them. But the point I'm making is you go back to the bigger picture. Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Führer, right? Of course, presidents would like to have absolute power. Not just Obama, the Marxist. Bush would have liked it. LBJ would have liked it. You name the president, they all would have liked to have absolute power. And the genius of our founders, though I have to repeat it for you again, was that we absolutely didn't want absolutism. And so the founding fathers set up a split government. Two parties came along later, but they set up a split government, balance of powers, right? Separation of powers. And that was set up so that no one man or no one group could take over the country. That's why we seem to think that Congress is crippled. That's actually a good sign. It's supposed to be crippled. In a dictatorship, the budget would have been resolved overnight. Ein Führer would have written the budget. That's all. If you didn't like it, he put you in a gas chamber. So the fact that they're fighting over taxes and they're fighting over whatever they call Social Security and Medicaid and welfare, what do they call it now? Entitlements. I love the word entitlements. I'd give them an entitlement to bums. Half the immigrants who sneak into this country don't work. They sit at home and blow dope day and night and drink beer in their hovels, and then they hate America on the side. Don't tell me what goes on. I'm no fool. I don't read the propaganda. They sit here in these houses here all over the country, sitting around blowing dope and drinking beer and cursing America. They tell me about immigration. They're not my father, okay? They're not my grandfather. They're not your grandfather. Don't tell me they're all the same. Don't give me that rubbish. I've been around the block a few times, and I've been around the nation a few decades. You know what I'm saying? Don't give me the garbage. They're all the same. So anyway, of course he'd like to give them more welfare and more bennies. Why does he? Because more votes. That's all. That's what a dictator would like to do, but he can't do it. So that's why he's turning gray. He's finding out finally that although the skids were greased for him since childhood, now all of a sudden he has to actually deal with things. He has to negotiate. He's not used to it. He's used to dictating and getting his way, or at least doing what people wanted done and getting it done for them, whichever way you want to look. So he's turning gray because it's very hard to reach that point where you realize you're no longer in total charge, which is the way it should be in a democracy, a relative republic like ours, democracy. Call it what you want. I don't even like the word democracy, but okay, that's what they call it. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Jason in New York, you oppose the death penalty. Tell us why. You're on the Savage Nation from the great WOR.
I was going to start by asking if you think life has value.
If I think life has value?
Yes.
I, of all people, know life has value. I have great value for human life, which is why I am opposed to abortion and why I support the death penalty for known murderers.
Okay, how does that value vanish when somebody commits murder?
Well, I'll turn it around on you. Let's start so I know where you're coming from, since I've given you a clear slate of mine. Are you in favor of abortion?
I am opposed to abortion.
So you're opposed to abortion, and you're opposed to the death penalty, so you are consistent in your opposition to ending human life.
I will say that when it comes to first trimester, then the idea of pain comes in, but that's a separate topic.
Wait, I'm sorry. You say in the first trimester you're in favor of abortion?
I say that the concept of being able to feel pain matters.
So you're not really supporting human life. You're just supporting the absence of pain, is what you just said.
Why are you claiming that it's life in the first trimester?
Well, now we're going to an area that we should discuss. What would you call a fetus in the first trimester? Death?
It's certainly not the same as an adult or as even a baby.
No, of course not. A 10-year-old isn't the same as an adult, nor a 9-year-old, 8-year-old, 15-year-old.
Yes.
We understand that. But that's not the issue. The issue is, have you ever planted a seed and watched it grow from a seed into a seedling?
I have.
Okay, we all did that in fifth grade, right? We put a lima bean seed in water or soil, and we saw a sprout come out. Would you argue that the emergence of that sprout is not life?
We're getting a little bit off of topic here.
Because you lost the argument. The chess game is over. I'm the grandmaster. You've just come to see something new in your own life, which is that life begins when it begins, not when the vermin who like to kill babies say it begins. So now let's go back to the death penalty. If you're a man who is so sensitive to life, why is it that you don't see the crime he committed? Let me ask you that without getting angry one way or the other.
All right. I already asked you the question, which you haven't answered, which is, why does that value of life vanish when somebody commits murder?
Well, because the man has abrogated his right to life by committing such a despicable act upon a young girl.
How does that happen? How
does it happen? You mean there are no crimes that you can think of that are worthy of the death penalty? None whatsoever?
None whatsoever.
Okay, then let me ask you this. If you could have had Hitler before you in a court after World War II, where so many millions were so brutally murdered, would you say he should have avoided the death penalty?
You're bringing up Hitler, and it's a good example because Hitler's probably the most emotional example you can bring up. But the fact is I'm fundamentally opposed, which means Hitler would have to be included by that fundamentally.
All right, well, at least you're a rational man who sticks to his guns. And what would keeping Hitler alive have done for humanity?
Oh, no, it wouldn't have done anything good. But the idea is the value of life, or if we're going to say that life has any value to begin with, you can't necessarily take that away just because somebody did the most atrocious acts imaginable. And by the way,
hold on. But you don't think that the death penalty doesn't send a message to the next mass murderer or to the next rapist that if he does it, if he gets caught, you're going to die a horrible death? You don't think that scares them?
Well, Dr. Savage, there's no evidence to suggest that the death penalty does actually deter murder.
Well, I've heard that from the left wing, but there's no proof to that matter. I personally think it creates another form of crime deterrent. The only reason the death penalty does not deter crime to the extent that it once did is precisely because the very same left wing lawyers who keep them alive forever have given the death penalty almost no meaning whatsoever. If they were given one or two appeals and they were executed forthrightly, once it was definitively proven that they committed that crime worthy of the death penalty, I think there'd be far fewer such murders in this country.
That may be the case, but the fact is that the evidence doesn't suggest that that's so. Now,
The evidence does not suggest that is not so because you are citing evidence of those who oppose the death penalty. I am certain I could show you evidence to the contrary, but I think we're going to have a legalistic argument, which is not what we're really interested in discussing. You are actually raising a far more fundamentally important point, which is that you asked me right off the bat, do I think that human life, how did you put it again, has value?
Yeah, fundamentally.
Of course it has fundamental value, but there are cases where a human being forfeits that right to life. It's not an absolute right. In other words, there are crimes that a person can commit
that take them outside of the human family. They're no longer humans. They're subhumans.
The fact is that it's vastly inconsistent to be opposed to abortion and pro-death penalty. It doesn't make any sense.
No, it isn't, because the fetus is innocent. The fetus is a clean slate. The fetus is put here by the will of nature or the will of God, and it has an unlimited capacity to do good on the earth. But this man has forfeited his right to live. He has said, I do not deserve to live. I am less than a human being. I cannot be rehabilitated. You know, you cite statistics. How about the recidivism rate of people who were let out of jail? How about the recidivism rate of Muslim terrorists who were let out of Guantanamo? How many of them returned to jihad? Too many of them. They should have all been executed, as far as I'm concerned. Why are they being released and sent back to go and kill our men on the battlefield? Perhaps even come to your city and kill you?
Can I respond?
I hope you would.
All right. I think you're getting a little bit off topic. The main idea with the death penalty is when you're killing the person, right? You're making the statement that he forfeited his right to life. Please explain rationally how that happens. That's why I'm opposed to the death penalty.
I don't understand. What do you mean rationally how that happens? How many different ways do I have to say it to you? If a man takes a young girl, brutally rapes her, pokes out her eye with a stick, bashes her head in with a rock, what has he done? Said, I'm a man worthy of living?
No, but has he said my right to life is gone now? That's the argument.
It's not up to him to say my right to life is gone. It's up to society to say your right to life has just been abrogated. You've just forfeited your right to life because of what you have done. You are lower than an animal. An animal wouldn't kill that way.
This is where I think intelligent people could disagree.
What if a bear in Yellowstone National Park, who just killed a man because the bear was protecting her cub? He killed a man. Horrible story. If you were there and you were that man's friend and you had a .45 caliber gun with you, would you have shot the bear while he was killing your friend?
While he was killing my friend, that's very different than after he already killed the friend.
But you would have shot the bear to try and save your friend, wouldn't you?
To save the friend while it's happening, yes. That's very different.
So if you were next to the young girl then and you had a gun, would you have shot the man to save her?
If I could knock him out, and instead, I certainly would.
You couldn't knock him out. You couldn't knock out a fly. I can see by your arguments.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
If I were a normal man, A, I would have been dead 30 years ago from what I've been through. That's number one. B, I certainly wouldn't have worked today with what I have going on in the back of my head. It's like when you turn, even you can feel the blood throbbing in the back of your neck. And if I talk too loud, I feel like the pain. I know. I'm not calling anyone. I'll work through it. If it gets worse, what'll happen? I'll work my way through it. It's because I was raised like to be stung by the ants, like the South American hunters. Why do you think I was telling you? Do you understand the point I'm trying to make? The reason the nation is dying is because the people are weaklings, in plain English. The American people are weaklings. Yes, there's been a profusion of phenomenal athletes. And I mean in the average classes of people. I don't just mean professionals. Rock climbers and bicyclers and martial artists, tremendous profusion, but by and large, we're a nation of weaklings, raised to be comfortable. And consequently, when you feel a slight quirk or pain, oh, I need a medication. I need to go to Medicare, Medicaid, the doctor. Why isn't the government paying? I want more prescriptions. That's why we're broke. You got to be toughened up, and you don't want to be toughened up. No one does. You want everything for free, and you don't want to hear that you got to be responsible for your own fatness or your own sickness. And you are, and to some extent, of course, there's mysterious elements and accidents. But by and large, you have your health in your own hands. If you are born with reasonably good health, by and large, the health that you are now living with is a result of your lifestyle, in plain English. Plain English. I mean, this is an accepted fact around the world. Since the beginning of time, since Paleolithic times, the mother Paleolith probably said to the child Paleolith, don't eat that garbage, it'll make you sick. Or don't hang around with those kids in the other cave, they're going to have you inhale that junk from that tree over there which killed your Uncle Manny. You know what I'm saying? So there's common sense. So when I say to you, I was raised by a father who said to me, You got to go to work when you're young. You got to sell, you know, learn how to sell, learn how to bear boredom. The most important thing, by the way, is learning. You want to hear the toughest thing is bearing boredom in our society. That is probably the toughest job of all. There was the case of the astronaut. He could fly to the moon, came back, right, and had a nervous breakdown when he had to go out with his wife to the supermarket on Saturday. I mean, that can kill anybody, but that's what did him in. He could handle the rigors of being an astronaut, flying to the moon. Came back about 2 months later, he had a breakdown and went into a nut house. Why? Because he couldn't take the normal life. I mean, his big venture was backing the Buick up in a Safeway parking lot without running anyone over. And he had to, like, make sure he didn't hit the wrong pedal. I mean, could put anyone into a bug house. The point I'm making is you got to make yourself tough, and your kids have to be raised tough. It doesn't mean you have to be mean or cruel or vicious to them, but you have to raise them in a tough way. So you say, well, oh, that's old-fashioned. That's all gone out with the window. We do it the Spock way, which is positive reinforcement. Oh, Johnny, good job. I go past the Little League field. I get sad for these kids. The kid misses. The bat flies out of his hand. He falls down. Good job, Johnny. At least you didn't break your neck. Good job, they're yelling at a little two-year-old. They put him in a they got him dressed up like a goon already. The two-year-old goon, they bought him a suit with the hat. And the kid swings and misses and falls down crying. The father says, good job, Johnny, good job. What good job? The kid swung and missed. What good job? I don't mean you run up and say, idiot, you missed. You don't have to do that. You say, here's how you hit a ball. The way you did it was wrong. There's a right. Oh, you can't say wrong. Because then you're interfering with the liberal education. See, to a liberal, there's no such thing as a wrong in an education other than loving your country. If you believe in borders, language, and culture, you're wrong. But other than that, there's no such thing as wrong. So now I'm going to again bring up the example, South America, the tribes in Brazil, deep in the jungles of Brazil. They inhale, they snort the hallucinogenic ayahuasca, which I believe has a component in it. The last I checked, which was similar to an LSD high, and they get stoned out of their mind with the shaman. I love the shaman. Another guy been getting stoned since he's a kid. Shaman, as far as I'm going to. All right, so the shaman tells him to snort the gun, and then you go into another world and this and that. But then they teach him to hunt. He's got to go out and hunt, right? He's got to hunt in the jungle. There's no supermarket. So what does he got? He's got a loincloth and a bow and arrow and a spear. The guy's got to go out and provide for himself and his family. He can't call up the Department of Health and Human Services and say, deliver me food or I'll sue you. A, there are no lawyers from NYU in the jungle yet. And B, they know how to hunt, and they'll raise from childhood to hunt. All right, so you can't walk out naked in the jungles of South America without expecting to be stung by ants, the fire ants, right? So you have to learn how to put up with being stung without even yelling out. You can't whimper. Why? Because let's say you're hunting a jaguar. And I don't mean in a showroom. Let's say you're hunting a jaguar, or you're hunting a monkey, or you're hunting for whatever you're hunting for. It requires the stealth of an animal. Therefore, no sound. Therefore, the man is trained to take the multiple stings of this fire ant all over his body. And if he whimpers, he's considered a punk, a coward, a loser, a girl, the lowest of the low of the men. He's not considered even a man if he lets out so much as a whimper. Why is that? Because they're mean? No. Because unless the man learns to sustain, to maintain his composure, even under severe pain, he's going to be he's not going to be able to provide for himself and his family. In fact, he'll probably get killed altogether. He'll just be useless to the tribe. So there's a story in that you have to take home to your children and not be so brainwashed into thinking that you're going to hurt their feelings or you're going to ruin them if you say you did it wrong. Stop with this garbage already. You know, I have a little country place somewhere on a hill in Northern California, which I go to from time to time. The house is way up on a hill, and it's up at the treetop level. It's on a very angled hill, so the treetops are below the deck. And they're Monterey pines. And unfortunately, the Monterey pines have been hit with a disease, and they're losing a lot of their foliage. That's a separate story. But I'm watching a battle going on over the last month. There is I'm not a bird expert. I'm not at all into ornithology. I wish I knew more about it. But I believe she is a peregrine falcon. They're not a particularly large bird. She is protecting her nest from black, what we call turkey vultures here, who are trying to steal her eggs. You should see this little mother bird. You should see her flying around from tree to tree. And this is going on now every day for a month. And, you know, you want to reach out and help the bird. You can't. It's the it's Darwinian. It's survival of the fittest. I just, yesterday, I was up there, and you see this poor bird, this beautiful bird. She sits up there, and she looks down, and then they start to circle her, and she comes down and dive bombs them, and then they try to dive bomb her, and she's smaller than them. Now, what is that story all about? What's that story about? It's about nature. Nature is brutal. Nature is just simply brutal. What does that have to do with politics? Exactly the same thing. Talk radio is very much alive. Although the midstream media has been claiming for years now that talk radio is dead, that the empty skirts who have been saying that this is a medium only for fringe extremists or old men, that talk radio is only for old men, I've proven them all wrong. Mark Masters, Talk Radio Network, and Michael Savage are partners. We've been in business together since when? 2000? Now, we all hear that the Internet is the king, and a lot of people ran to the Internet with their advertising money. Yet everyone knows that no one's been able to monetize their investment in the Internet. Nobody. You see, talk radio is a medium that you can't hide yourself easily in. You can't hide behind a mustache and such. 3 hours a day, Jerry. 3 hours a day, Jerry. Mr. Mustache on Fox. And unless you have a massive production staff who is talking for you, you're not going to get very far, right? But I don't have a massive staff. I have a very small and very good staff. And when you do talk radio right, people get to know you. People get to understand that you're a real person, and they relate to you. What I'm saying is I've proven that talk radio is a very vibrant medium today. People who listen to talk radio are more acutely aware of what's going on than the average American. Although the fraudulent elites, or shall I say the self-proclaimed drug addicts with microphones and cameras in front of their faces, laugh at you, the average listener to talk radio is far more knowledgeable politically than they would like you to believe. And by the way, listeners to talk radio vote both with their wallets and their ballots. Russia, China, Iran, they are our adversaries. We are the peregrine falcon. We are the eagle. They are trying to steal our eggs and make certain that we no longer reproduce. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Do you understand what I am saying to you? It's dog eat dog. And unfortunately, our top dog is working for the other side, either on purpose or because he doesn't know what he's doing.
Savage.
Normal people are somewhere else already. If you're listening to this show, it means there's something wrong with you at this time of the day. There's something wrong in your life. If you've tuned into talk radio, listen to me, when you have internet and you have all these other choices, I'm not trying to send you away. It's not like I'm a bad businessman, but if you're listening to this show, it means that there's something a little off with you. I don't mean you're like the guy who did it in Brooklyn, don't get me wrong, but there's something wrong. You should normally be with a family tonight, breaking bread, children, but they don't talk to you. You don't have any family. That's why you're listening to the show. I'm family to you. I became the patriarch in your life. I am the father figure. I'm the uncle figure. I'm the lover figure. I'm the brother figure. I'm the son figure. I'm the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost figure. That's why I'm so popular. I fill all of these roles. I am everything, and I am nothing. And that's the beauty of radio. Did you know that that's the, did you see the, did you ever read the book, Miss Lonely Hearts? Does anyone, raise your hand if you know what I'm talking about. Miss Lonely Hearts. Written, I believe, by in the 19... I can't fill in the details. Beowulf, you're good on these things. Who wrote Miss Lonely Hearts and when?
Nathaniel West.
Nathaniel West. When, 1930?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Thereabouts. And it was about a... wasn't it about a newsman that people lived through? He had a column. He had a column for the lonely. And then, he fulfilled all of these fantasies for people. And at the end of the book, he's swarmed by them like ants or bees, and they smother him to death. And that's what happens. So that's why I broadcast in isolation in a lone studio. And another reason I don't exercise very much anymore is because I work out on the radio. I found out a little trick, you don't realize it, with only eating why I didn't gain 100 pounds. Here's the answer. I do a little calisthenics in the morning and ride the bike a bit. But I've slacked off from my old exercise regimen. Who needs? I don't really care about it anymore. It's not like I've given up. Explain why. Like, I work in a studio that's about 10 by 12, right? When I came in the studio, no air conditioning, no ventilation. I didn't want it on because I don't like cold. The temperature in here was 64 degrees from the ambient air. I've been on the air about an hour now. The temperature's 69 degrees. I've increased the temperature in here by 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Where did it come from? Came from me. I generate so much energy on this show that it's like working out. It's like doing bench presses, labs, abs, whatever. And the fact of the matter is, my labs don't need to run around the lake. You know what I'm saying? That's a metaphor. I don't need to make my labs jump in the bay and chase a false fish. Because when I'm on the radio, I'm running, basically, and I'm burning. I actually sweat at the end of a show. If you're not sweating and you're not exhausted, first rule of radio, if when you get off the air, you're not exhausted, you didn't do a good show. Did you know that? If you don't give it your all, you know what? Do me a favor, quit. You don't belong in this business. Give it your all. Stress yourself out. Push yourself. Dig within yourself. Come up with the best things you can. Do your work. Raise your body temperature. Then you're going to do a show people will listen to. And if you're not exhausted, if you're just blowing it off, you know what? You're off the air. You're not going to last another year. I'm telling you, that's the way it is. So tonight, for example, I was telling you, I'll be agitated anyway, so I'm not going to go to sleep. What's the point of going to sleep if I can't sleep, right? So I'm going to go to the San Francisco, to the North Beach area, to have Italian food, because it's calamari night and codfish night in a certain restaurant I know. Now, I generally only eat in one Italian restaurant now, the North Beach restaurant. I mean, Lorenzo's a friend of mine. He and I like kibitz with each other all the time. I drive him crazy. He drives me crazy. He tries to put salt on my food. I mean, he drives me out of my mind. But I love the guy. I love the restaurant. But I hope he's not listening, God, because I'm not going there tonight. I don't go anywhere else. I do not recommend any other restaurant anymore in the city. No more Italian, nothing. End of story. Don't go anywhere else. Only go there. You'll never find me there because I'm never there. But I'm going to be in the area. If you're looking for me, you'll not find me. But I'm going to go where they serve calamari tonight and codfish. They make a codfish. Oh, my God. And then I'll walk around the streets looking at the lunatics. We call the city at this time of year the Redneck Riviera. Old story, but it is. Nothing wrong with it. I mean, if you like the wife beater guys in the fog and the girls walking around with the jelly rolls underneath their pants. That's very with the tight pants that Laura talked. That's a terrific place to see all of them. They don't know what they're looking at. And the Europeans are there shivering as usual in the summertime. They think they were going to Mexico. They're going to California. They're going to put on shorts and they walk around the blonde hair standing up because it's like on the steps of Russia in 1941. They don't understand what Mark Twain said. The coldest winter, hottest summer, you know that one. I never spent the colder winter than the summer in San Francisco. It's true, and thank God that's why I live here. Tyler, Texas. Is this Tina? Tina, welcome to the program.
Yes, it is. Michael, you had mentioned that people that listen to your show at this time, there's probably something wrong with them, and you are probably right. I find that being my age, I'm a young 48. I began listening to you when I was 30-something, and the very first thing that I heard, I didn't even know your name, but I turned the radio on, and there was this booming voice that was so pleasant, and you said the funniest thing. You said, you would rather see a Texas girl getting out of a truck than a liberal woman driving a Pinto with a mustache. And
that's funny.
I laughed, and you had me from there. I was absolutely.
Well, in San Francisco, if a woman doesn't have a mustache, she's called in for questioning by the police department.
Oh, let me tell you, I told my husband because, I'm a beautiful girl, as a lot of Texas women are. We take pride in the way we look. I drive an Escalade and I drive a truck. I wear jeans and I wear boots and I wear pearls and dresses. So I'm very comfortable with who I am. But I find that a lot of people my age, especially women, they irritate me because they are not very intelligent. Now, I have a high school education, that's all. I haven't gone to college. And I find you so intriguing and so interesting, not intimidating in any kind of way. And sometimes I get mad at you at some of the things you say politically because I'm one of those real far, far right. But yet I tell my husband, I said, you know, I may go to bed being mad at Michael, but I wake up loving him every day.
Well, you're saying I'm too liberal for you, in other words.
No, not always. In some things you are. Sometimes you can be a little harsh, but that's just because Southerners...
What is the most liberal thinking I have ever projected on my show?
Sometimes...
Let's say something you would have problems with as a right-wing Texas girl. What have I said that strikes you as too liberal? Does it come to mind?
Sometimes some of your religious point of views, because you're very you read a lot from the Old Testament, and I know you're very schooled in that, and I'm a Christian, and some of the things you say I agree with, and some of them I really
don't. I don't understand. So which, like, what from the Old Testament offended you? I'd like to know. I'd like to hear.
I really can't say that it offended me so much. It just...
What, you shall not eat shrimp or pork or something? I didn't say.
No, I do that too.
I don't care what you eat. You can eat pork. You know, the Chinese are releasing pork stores. The price of pork went up 38%. The Chinese are releasing pork bellies now on the world market because the price of pig has gone up. But that's a side note. Well, I'm glad you're still listening after 18 years. So you're 48. You started listening to me at 30?
Yeah, 30-something. I was in my late 30s.
And were you married? Were you already married at that time?
I was just getting married. And
now, wait, this is very important. Does your husband know you listen to the Savage Nation?
All the time. Oh, as a matter of fact, he was listening to you last night, and he comes in and he goes, "Did you hear what Michael said?" And I said, "Yes," and he is in total agreement.
No, it's a great state. Texas is a great state. If you had fog, like I have here, I'd move there in a minute, but I can't move to any place without fog. It's that simple. I love people from Texas. It's a great state. Forget the no tax. That's an issue, sure. It's very business-friendly. California's bleeding businesses that are running out of the state. They're moving to Texas, Utah, and places where their taxes are lower and people are... First of all, you have a better workforce there. They're politer. They know what work is. It's a disaster here to run a business. But because you don't have any fog in Corpus Christi, I cannot move there. Thank you for the call. And secondly, if you go in... Like, if I go to, let's say, Texas, for example, I wouldn't fit in anywhere. Wherever I go, I don't fit in. I'm a loner, so I don't fit in anywhere. I must have a certain degree of like creature comforts, or else I can't live there. That's all there is to it.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The movie I saw that's related to the war against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, in some ways, it was a movie called Lion of the Desert, done in 1981. I saw it on Turner Classics, I think, the other night. And I just stumbled on it. I was shocked by how good it was and how I was captivated by it. Anthony Quinn plays the so-called rebel leader, a Libyan hero, who helped the Libyans fend off an Italian invasion in 1929. Anthony Quinn stars as Omar Mukhtar, one of his finest roles ever, who organized Libyan forces to hold off the encroaching Italian troops under General Graziano, played by Oliver Reed, who were trying to dominate Libyan soil under direct orders from the Italian dictator of Mussolini, played by Rod Steiger. Now, this is an amazing story that I did not know even existed, and I thought I knew about most movies that have ever been done. What you don't know is that with the persistence of this ex-school teacher, Mukhtar, the Libyans battling the tanks and guns of the Italian army with their Bedouin troops on horseback managed to hold off the Italian fascists for 20 years until Mukhtar was finally captured and executed. It's astounding. Anthony Quinn, Oliver Reed, Iron Pappas, Rod Steiger, and John Gielgud. It's a movie you should watch for the historic lessons in it. Lion of the Desert. Highly recommended, acting superb, the historical sweep amazing, and there's a lot to be learned from this movie about the futile efforts we are conducting in the Arab worlds today. Yes, I said it. Yes, you can mark it down and you can call me any name you want. Just remember how to spell my name, Savage. the futile efforts we are engaging against the Arab world. There is no way in the world they're ever going to stop fighting, because in the last scene, Mukhtar is written to, I mean, he said this in the movie because it's a script, and through the character Anthony Quinn, he said, I will outlive the hangman. He says to the Italian dictator Mussolini before they take him out to hang him, he says to him, I will outlive your hangman. And he said, after you kill me, my children will fight you, and my children's children will fight you, and their children's children will fight you. You will never occupy our land with any peace. So then, you know, there's a lot in there. You know, Mussolini shows him coins, Italian coins, going back 1,000 years from when Italy once conquered Northern Africa way in ancient times before this. And the Anthony Quinn character says, yes, I can show you Greek coins, I can show you Turkish coins, but they're all gone. It's an amazing story. Absolutely amazing story. And I highly recommend it for you and your children. Lion of the Desert, 1981, Anthony Quinn. I'm going to watch it again. Amazing movie. If you like history and you like excitement, it's actually better than that other one that was done around the same time that got all the acclaim, Lawrence of Arabia, which was also a fine film of its time. In New Mexico, Mark, you're on the Savage Nation.
I remember seeing that movie. I saw it originally when it came out. What an awesome performance by Anthony Quinn. Only he could play something like that. Well, I was thinking about this movie when we started with Libya recently, and so-called supposedly NATO, and think to myself, it would be a big mistake if we got involved in the ground war.
These are big topics. New York, George from WOR, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yes, Dr. Savage, I just want to make a point that no matter who we try to induct into the military to make a political point, the fact is that we always create soldiers no matter what they come from, and if we always mold them into soldiers, whether they're gay...
Wait, you're not making any sense. What does that have to do with anything? So you're saying women on submarines will make the submarine a better, submariners a better organization?
No, it just means that it makes soldiers no matter what.
Well, you're just repeating a homily over and over again. Do you have any idea what women on submarines will do to the submarine fleet in terms of the men on the boats? Can you figure that one out?
They're always conditioned in training during boot camp to be...
You know, you're like a robot. You're like a robot. You're repeating... What, did you get a piece of paper with this on it? If a woman is on a submarine, there are still men and women. There's the elements of a man and a woman. Don't you suspect that there are going to be some affairs on the submarine and that the submarines will become love boats?
I still believe there's still some decorum of humanity. No matter,
well, that's because you're a fool. I mean, I was a visitor aboard an aircraft carrier. You ask anyone serving what goes on these ships. Do you have any idea in the real world as opposed to the newspaper world that you live in what goes on ships today because of women on ships? Do you have any idea the chaos that this has imposed upon surface ships?
I believe in...
No, you don't believe. You believe. You believe. That's your answer. You believe. You believe. Okay, whatever. Virginia, Quinton, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Savage. I'm a little confused by your whole thing with the submarine. I understand the whole dichotomy with having women on a ship, but I'm trying to understand and figure out why making such a big deal about this, considering...
I'll tell you why I make such a big deal about it. If you knew about the statistics in the Navy, you would understand why I'm making a big deal about it. Do you know what percentage of so-called sailors are getting thrown out of the Navy at full pension, full benefits, because they're pregnant and they're getting knocked up on ships?
How often does that happen? Please give me...
It's a very, very large percentage, and it's sucking the budget, which has already been reduced to the bone, cut to the bone.
At the Israeli army, where you have men, women...
Right, don't bring up the Israeli army. It's nothing compared to the U.S. army. Stop with the Israeli army. The Israeli army is no model for the world. They couldn't even defend themselves in Lebanon. I'm sick of about the great Israeli army. It's reduced to rubble lately. Israeli army. What's the Israeli army today? Without the U.S., Israel would disappear.
Very true. I'll give you that one.
All right, thanks. I'm glad you'll give it to me. The Israeli army. Great Israeli army. Israeli army. Oh, Hezbollah sank a ship, and the Israelis couldn't defend themselves in the Lebanon war. They almost lost that war. In fact, they already lost it. Women on ships have been a disaster. It's a social experiment that was started long before Barack Hussein Obama. And now Obama's added the cherry on the pie by putting them on submarines, which is a whole different world. It's a different culture. It's a different culture. You go on a Navy ship and you see these kids, these young kids just out of high school. Half of them are pimply-faced kids. They gave them a uniform and shoes, and now they have a job. Thank God. They get on the chow line. 1,000 of them marching around. It looks like a high school on the ships today. Thank God we still have an officer class that can still run the ship. And then you have the drones running around. And what do you think they're doing during the spare time? They're having sex on the ships. And the women are becoming pregnant on the ships. Then they're getting sent back off the ships so they can raise their baby with no father at full government expense. That's a result of the social experiment imposed upon the military by Patricia Schroeder and the other harridans who originally enforced this upon the military. So now Obama's ratcheting it up and putting women on submarines. Since I've had my espresso, and since I'm not going to sleep tonight anyway because I'm sacrificing tonight's sleep for today's show, as I did last night. I've been up, I think, for about 36 hours. No, I slept, but I didn't sleep. It was like a tossed, horrible, you know, the nightmares were daymares in the middle of the night. But there was nowhere to go in there. The problem is I have nothing to do in the middle of the night. What do you do in the middle of the night when you can't sleep? I have answers to that, too, because there was a period in my life that I was totally insomniac, and I thought I would die from a lack of sleep. And then I read a lot of books on insomnia, and I found out that insomnia can be your best friend. What it means is you don't really need to sleep. You're not tired. Most of us sleep when we don't even have to, incidentally. This is a myth that you have to sleep. It's like a myth like you have to have 3 meals a day or that you have to drink 8 glasses of water or three cups of milk a day or whatever. You're not tired, so you're not sleeping. The trick is to not lay in bed. I remember reading one book during this period when I couldn't sleep, and it was mainly money worries. It was money worries because of a lot of reasons, whatever. The kids were young, and I was worried about their future and my future and what am I going to do, and I killed myself and they won't hire me because I'm a white male and they're hiring idiots and morons and putting them into jobs they're not qualified for and perverts, which of course was 100% true. Just take a look at your universities today, putting what they're doing in the universities outside the science departments, which of course, unfortunately for them, they can't yet populate with their inferior plants because either you understand the periodic table of the elements or you don't. You can't quite do what you do in the social sciences. Nevertheless, I'm up, I'm this and that. So I get a book that says more people have died worrying about a lack of sleep than from a lack of sleep, and I forget who wrote the book. And it was like 10 things you could do. Someone's going to write this down, steal it, and make a book out of it probably. That's okay. I don't really care. Go ahead and do it. And I learned a lot of different techniques. The number one thing was I went out on my deck and looked at the stars. And that's when I started to love stars again after childhood. You see, okay, I'm up. It's dark. The sky is black. The stars are bright. What am I going to do with the time? How about getting out a book that shows me star formations? So there they were. And then slowly, you know, and the next one is learn to read, learn to do this, learn to do that. And before long, when you stop worrying about not sleeping, you wind up sleeping again. It's like everything else. You understand that or not? Sure, it's like everything else. Is, you know, there used to be an adage amongst guys that a lot of guys are always hungry for a date for a woman and they couldn't get one. And the guys who did always had the same story to tell, which is that women can tell when you're nervous and you want a woman and they'll avoid you like you have leprosy. That the only guys women want are the ones who don't want them or let's say are aloof and really don't care. It's a terrible reality. It's the same the other way too, by the way. You know, you get desperate, the other party can sense it like an animal. Well, how is it put? We pursue that which retreats. Have you heard that one in the dating world? It's pretty much true in the business world as well. We pursue that which retreats. So the best thing to do is retreat, even when you want to pursue, in most cases. It's a terrible rule, but it's like hunting, and you ask a hunter. There's only one way to hunt, or there's only a particular few ways to hunt, and none of them consist of rushing right at the animals. But that's neither here nor there. So let's go back to the insomnia before I get too far off the track. There are many other things you can do. And, of course, I learned to use passion flower herbal tea. I was very into the whole story there. And that's a great – wait, hold it. There's my story. Let me tell you how I learned to use passion flower herbal tea and how not only did it give me relief from insomnia, but I then learned to carry this tea around with me all over the world in my travels. And it became a great relaxant on airplanes. I didn't have to drink any alcohol. I didn't need the 2 little bottles of wine that they used to have in those days. Remember those days they served you wine in those 2 little bottles that you got? The El Cheapo wine bottles that were on airplanes. Now it's bottled wine. Well, anyway, so I heard about a guy, a pharmacist in San Francisco on Ellis Street. He was like an old guy, about 85, 88 at the time. And he was an old timer going way, way back. I don't know what his name was. He was an old Jewish guy named Morris. He was right near the Glide Memorial Church, as a matter of fact, which is a largely African-American a church. And I forget the name of the pharmacy. He's since passed on. I go in there because I heard he knew everything about herbal medicine. He was a real pharmacist as opposed to people who were faking it with chlamydia and half mustaches in the health food stores. And I come in and right away I say to him, do you have a passion flower herbal tea? See, he says to me, why, who are you? What do you want? It was like right out of Brooklyn, and the guy, it was in San Francisco. I said, no, I just, he said, what, are you an inspector with the FDA? I have nothing. Get out of my store. That's how it started. I don't have nothing. I have no herbal tea, he says to me. That's all he sold. So I said to him, well, I heard you sell herbal tea. I don't know who you heard from. I have nothing here. I'm a regular drugstore. So I said, calm down. I had to show him one of my books. He was afraid I was an inspector, in other words. I think he had been busted by the FDA for selling real products that work called herbal medicine instead of toxic chemicals that killed and addicted people called pharmaceuticals. So we got to talk, and he said, what's your problem? I said, I can't sleep. He says, look, mister, you're still wasting your time. He said, go across the street to Joe's Bar and have 2 shots of scotch and go home. You'll fall asleep. I have nothing for you.
Savage.
I'm going to prove something to you right now. This is a daring act I'm about to perform, which is I'm going to read the label on a box of bullets, 380 auto, 90 grain bullets, and I'm going to show you that I can even make that interesting, even the people who don't have guns. I'm going to read you something, right? Lead warning. Discharging firearms in poorly ventilated areas, cleaning firearms, or handling ammunition may result in exposure to lead and other substances known to cause birth defects and reproductive harm. Why it's in English and French, I don't understand. Why would they make a bullet box in French and English? That's the part I can't understand. The French haven't used guns in 100 years. How many Frenchmen would buy centerfire cartridges? There's a warning here for children on the box. French, they're not allowed to have guns in France, are they? So why would they even make this in France? I don't understand this. This is like a cheap centerfire cartridge, maybe. It could be in Louisiana or something that they speak French, don't they, down in there on the bayou? I mean, no slur intended. 380 is a terrible round, by the way, for home defense. I don't think it'll work. You know, everyone says, oh, it's not going to work. God, I wouldn't want to be hit by one. Guys always say, oh, don't get a 380, get a 40. Man, I don't want that thing going through me. What's wrong with the 380? Like a 32 is not good enough. Oh, okay, fine. I'll just shoot it through my splinter. It's not big enough. I'm into the 45. I mean, you're stopping power. I mean, in the case of a home defense weapon, let me tell you something, size matters. When it comes to the cartridge, you know, I mean, let's not fool around here. You got a guy coming in on PCP. You want something that'll knock him down, and it's got to be a 45. I don't care how big he is. I don't care what drug he's on. That's what it's designed for by the U.S. government. When they were in the Spanish campaign, the Philippines campaign, the Spanish-American War, wasn't it? And they were having, you know, this is an interesting thing historically, because I've studied this occasionally and only on a mild note, on a minor note. But apparently, weren't they fighting in the Philippines during the Spanish-American War as well, if I remember correctly? And weren't these fanatics using some kind of drugs in the jungles there, and they'd come screaming at the U.S. Marines, and no matter what they shot them with, the 38s, they'd keep coming with their machetes or bolo knives? So they went back and they said to the ballistics laboratory, develop a slug that'll stop them no matter what they're on. They came up with the 45. That was the origin of the development of the 45. You understand that? A straighter gun there is. I mean, that gun shoots straight. I'd rather avoid politics for a few moments. And remember, not truffles. The only topic I don't want to talk about is truffles. Conservatives do not eat truffles. Real men do not eat truffles. That's all I can say. Houston, Texas. Russell, quickly, fire away. You own a Duffy boat. Tell me about it. Do you like it?
I've got the 18-foot Duffy. It's a fantastic boat. It's 14 years old, extremely resilient.
I'm looking at the 18-foot Snug Harbor. Should I get it?
I think so. The great thing about it is when you're just putting around the harbor or in and out of a network of canals, there's no fumes. You know, if it's,
that's what I want. No fumes. I hate fumes.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Okay, Florida, Robbie, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. I am. I'm a Muslim American, actually American Muslim.
Right.
And I would like you to know that I'm a huge fan of yours, and I think you're one of the last philosophers out there. Not only philosophers.
That is an honor, my friend, to hear that from someone who could easily take me the wrong way.
No, absolutely not. You're not only a philosopher. I think you're one of the last knights, also, that you stand up for the truth and you stand up for what's right.
Wow, what a compliment. You're making my halo is glowing right now.
I never miss your show, man. I never do. And
But if you're a Muslim, you're a man who believes in God. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
So in believing in God, you're always seeking the truth, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so the whole quest for truth cannot be possible unless you believe in God.
Absolutely.
In other words, why would you care about the truth? In other words, this is the fundament of the whole damn thing. Unless you believe in God, how can you believe in truth? Truth is God. Truth is God is DNA, as I wrote when I was 16 years old in my journal. Truth is God is DNA. Whichever way you want to look at it, the equation comes out the same way. Why should anyone care about what the truth is if there is no God? Why seek the truth at all?
I have a theory, Michael, and I think that if people look at it this way, science, religion, is like chemistry, physics, math, history, geography. You got to combine everything together to start to understand how things go.
Absolutely agree with you. That's correct.
So in order to do physics, you need a little bit of math and a little bit of chemistry. Plus, you need to research history of what people before you have done. Geography, where is it at if you're looking for a mineral? So you need everything put together in a melting pot to come up with a clear idea of what's going on.
And you and I are like mental brothers. 100% right.
And I'm a huge fan of you, by the way. I have been listening to this show for years and years and years and years. And you made me a better thinker. And I really try to rush out of work at 7 just to start listening to your show. I go home, I go online to listen to you. I love the way you think. A huge fan of you. This is why I tell you you're also a knight, not only a philosopher, because very few men do stand up for the truth these days. And they say it as it is, as it's supposed to be said, like true men are supposed to be. And I have a little theory to share with you. It's called the theory of balance. I'm a Muslim, but I went to church for 16 years. I was raised in Beirut. And I immigrated over here. So I want.
Mm-hmm. But you're a unique individual. In Lebanon was so advanced as a Middle Eastern nation until it descended into civil war that I'm not surprised by what you're saying.
I was born during the civil war, so instead of my parents sending me to a Muslim school, they sent me to a Christian school, and they didn't want me to be one of those that say just Muslim is right or Christian is right. But
you're almost approaching that of Khalil Gibran, one of your brethren. Am I correct?
He was a great man. Yes, he is, and he's a great thinker also. And
right. When I was in college, he was very popular. People used to give Khalil Gibran's books as gifts. He's no longer, I think, as currently popular as he once was. He was Lebanese, correct?
Yes, he was.
People do not know that he was also a heroin addict or an opium addict. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
No, I don't say that in a derogatory sense. I think the man was so racked with pain, is psychic pain, that he found that he stumbled into drugs. I don't even take that away from him. He was still a great poet.
Yes.
So anyway, please go on with your point. I didn't mean to distract us.
Okay, that's okay. My point is I've been thinking, and you know, I went through an emotional stress, and you know, when you go through emotional stress, after that you come out clear or you come out defeated. So either you say there's no God, or you start saying, you know what, there's a truth and I have to find it. So the more I look into the truth, the more I found out there's something called balance. And everything in this universe, like God, is balanced. In Islam, they call God many names. He has 99 names. Some of them are very harsh. some of them are very kind and nice. If you look at all religions, God has two sides almost. One of them, he can punish, he can destroy, he can kill, he can take your life away. Also, on the other hand, he can give you life. He can heal
That's
you.
Right.
He can help.
Absolutely. I've come to that in my searching as well, which is that the dark and the light are actually one and the same. I see it as a sphere, not as a disc. People seem to want to see things in a two-dimensional mold rather than a three-dimensional model, rather. And so when they see only the light side and they want to say God is only the light, they don't understand God is also punishing or dark. And that's why the dark things occur on Earth.
We have to bring the idea of those consequences of what you do in this life to people in order for us to put this beautiful society. I immigrated to this country, and I ran out of civil war. Then I come over here, and there's this beautiful country, and I look at society, and I see what you say, those women throwing up on themselves, the female image, you know, declined, the male are less manly, and you see the society kind of like falling apart, and there's consequences for what you actions and decisions. What are we doing?
Yes, womanhood in America. Look at the role models for young girls in this society. It makes me weep. You look at the sluts on television. You look at the sluts in Hollywood. They seem to try to outdo each other for degenerate, slut, drunk, druggy behavior rather than something noble. How is that possible? How can a young girl grow up in this country half sane? It's almost impossible. Look at these shows, The Real Housewives of. I mean, it's pathetic to see women that look like post-op transvestites cavorting as though they're beauty stars.
Yes, and this brings my theory back that everything in this life, there's a balance. If there's a kid who's going to be very healthy, on the other hand, there's going to be a kid who is sick. In order for somebody to be very, very rich, there's going to be somebody who is very, very poor. And in order for good people to exist in this world, there's a must for bad people to exist. In order for good times to exist, there will be pain and sorrow, and, you know, you're going to feel sad sometimes. So it all comes back to a balance. And people who live happy, the word happy is very tricky because people misunderstand what happy is. Happy if you live in your own means, and if you live in a balanced way, in a simple way. The more you complicate life and you make it more complicated and you add to it, the harder it is to enjoy life.
Well, I have a friend who was raised by a religious Jewish family. He himself is somewhat, you know, not really religious. And he said to me, who is happy? He learned this from his teaching. Who is a happy man? He who is happy with his own lot. That's a heck of a statement when you think about that. It's not who's the richest. It's not who has the most girls. It's not who has the most toys. It's an interesting statement. Who is happy? Who is a happy man? He who is happy within his own lot. That can mean a man with a cabin in the mountains who finally found what he wanted. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And this is what I say when people ask me, like, Robbie, why, if there's a God, why does God create sick people? Then I would say, why would God create all the people healthy? To be super healthy, there's somebody who has to be sick at one point. Somebody has to be created. Not everybody is created with 100% health. There's a balance.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Nobody is created 100%. I agree with that 100%. None of us are supermen. All of us have failures. All of us have weaknesses. The trick is to know what your failures and weaknesses are so that you don't let them take over your being. And that goes back to Anthony Weiner. This man had a very bad weakness. I felt bad for him. You can only make jokes of it for a certain time. I felt bad for the guy, even though politically I don't like anything that he stands for. It was pathetic to watch a human being descend to this level of humiliation. Wouldn't you agree with me?
Absolutely. I don't wish anything bad on anybody. I mean, he's in a very tough situation. I don't care about the media or anything. I care about his kids and what his wife is going through at home. You know, their dad is...
So let me ask you the last question. She's a Muslim wife. She's probably a moderate, intelligent, advanced mind like yours. How could she stick with him?
There's something in Islam where a woman's real role comes in life is to protect a man's heart. This is how it's worded. One of the roles of a woman in a house, and not only to raise kids, is to protect a man's heart. So when a woman...
Wow. Whoa, that's beautiful, man. What a beautiful concept that is. I heard the reverse of what a man's job is. I heard this from an old Russian rabbi, not worth 10 cents, one of the brightest men I ever met in my life. And he said a husband is a house band. He's supposed to put a band around the house and the family and keep it together. That's a similar thing from the other side.
Yes, to be honest with you, I fell in love with a Jew. I almost married a Jew. I was with her for 5 years. And the more I knew her, the more she knew me, the more I found out Islam and Judaism are so close.
Well, they're cousin religions. I mean, Islam was derived from Judaism. Many of the beliefs of Islam are mimicked. I'm sorry to say it, but they're direct copies from Judaism.
Absolutely. And that's one thing. We broke up, but that's one thing we never argued about. We argue about everything else.
Well, all right, so the Jews celebrate Sabbath on Saturday, and the Muslims celebrate Sabbath on Friday, correct? And the Christians celebrate Sabbath on Sunday. That means you only work 4 days a week. You know, my friend, you and I could have a very nice conversation for a very long period of time. I don't know if my listeners would like it. I'll bet they would.
Savage.
I was a kid. Every summer, I loved the summer. What kid didn't? Because in those days, you didn't go to summer school. You didn't go to a camp to advance your mathematical knowledge, another to advance your sports knowledge, another to lose your tubby waist. You went and had fun for the whole summer. And we were kind of poor, so what we did was, to get out of the hot inner city, the family rented a small cottage with all the other families from the neighborhood and relatives, up in the cool mountains called the Catskill Mountains, and they were known as bungalow colonies because you got basically a one-room, kitchen, bedroom, bathroom, boom. It became like a little village. Naturally, it was paradise. So in one of these places, there was a guy who was a caretaker who lived in an old abandoned barn with his wife, believe it or not. And he like, mowed the lawn. He had the hammer, fixed the hammer. His name was Woodchuck Bill. And us kids, it was like a Tom Sawyer thing. We loved Woodchuck Bill. Kids loved. Now, remember, he was not a bum. See, today they're bum, they're homeless. He was what was known as a hobo in those days. And there were people who were hobos. They were sort of respectable in their own way. That was his job category. He was like hobo. He would put it on the IRS. Like, what do you do? Job category, hobo. I don't know what he made, next to nothing. But he lived up in this, as I say, ramshackle barn-like structure with his. He had a wife, actually. And Woodchuck Bill would regale us kids with his stories. And he was a big guy with a big stomach on him. So the story begins with him saying, "All right, kids, come over here. Today they probably arrest him for molestation, just for even telling us a story. Some freak would arrest him." He says, "All right, I want all of you to punch me in the stomach." Now, right away, that's rape today. It's raping a child in some way. So we'd all go up with our skinny little arms. We were 9, 8, 7, and punch him in the stomach, and nothing would happen. So naturally, we thought he was Superman. He must have been pretty strong. I mean, when you think about it, because they're 8-year-old kids that can give you quite a belt even today. Anyway, so we all hit him, and we realized we were nothing compared to Woodchuck Bill. Then we'd sit at his feet, and he would tell us stories. What I liked most about Woodchuck Bill was that he lived in this barn with almost nothing. He had his few pots and pans, him and a wife, and they hung from, like, hooks over the thing, and they actually cooked in there. But he said he used to eat woodchucks. We'd say, "Bill, what do you eat?" He said, we eat woodchucks. Who knows if he's telling the truth? I don't know if you can eat a woodchuck. And that's the Woodchuck Bill story. I mean, you wanted something more to it. There is nothing more. That's a jazz story. You got to understand jazz music to understand that story. It ends like boom, and the horn goes down. That's it. But unless you understand how jazz works, you're not going to be, like, satisfied, because you want a beginning, a middle, and an end. Talk radio is not a dying medium. It is stronger than ever. It is stronger than it's ever been before. In my 16 years in radio, Mark Masters, who has syndicated me for over 9 years now, and we're going to be, as Harry Truman said, give him you-know-what for the next couple of years. That's our job. Our job is to be watchdogs, not to be lapdogs, Mark. And I want to thank you for giving me total and absolute freedom to do so. That's the point I'm trying to make. I wouldn't have lasted a week with another syndicator. I could never have sat down after a show and been deconstructed where they say, "Well, you said this, tomorrow don't say that." That would have been the end of it for me. I've had total freedom. I need total freedom to function. And Mark, I want to thank you again. I'm glad we're going to be working together. And I know the American people, who particularly the millions and millions of people who listen to this show, are going to breathe a sigh of relief that we have this year to look forward to together. It's had its ups and downs. But right now, we have seen the talk radio in the Savage Nation are responsible for the mighty blow that is being struck against socialism in America. And I believe this will grow when it forces the Democrats off the political landscape for having introduced Democrat socialism and worse to the United States of America. Let me describe one thing for you about landing and taking off, because it was contested as to what is more frightening, if you want to put it that way, or more exciting, if you want to put it that way. So let us begin at the beginning. I don't want to build it up like I was an astronaut, but for me, it was pretty big deal, okay? Civilian, never flew a jet. I mean, never flew a combat plane. But I'll make it faster than slower. Strapped in, everyone tells you when you take off in the C-2 Greyhound, it's going to be like an ordinary routine flight for the 30 to 40 minutes, which is about how long it took from the North Station in San Diego to get out to the ship. But it was about 45 minutes out. Let's put it to you that way. So they said, it's going to be very, very rough when you land, I was told, because the pilots will often do a bank in a roll, a 90-degree roll, in order to slow the plane down. I said, even with distinguished visitors aboard? They said, yeah, no matter who's aboard, they'll come in and fly over the deck to get a bearing, and then they're going to make a sharp left bank and come around. And they said, then the fun begins, because remember, they got to hit the tail hook. There are four lines. There are four wires on that deck. Now, those of you who know anything about it know that they never want to hit the number one wire. Never. You'd say, wow, that would be better. No. The reason they don't aim for the number one wire is because it would mean the angle of approach is too low, and they're liable to smash into the carrier. So the preferred cables to grab, the number one preferred line is number three. They want to hit three line. You can hit two or three, but three is the best. If you hit four, it means you missed two or three. Now, you got to come in at full power. Why does the pilot have to come in at full power, meaning his engines are running at full speed? Because if he should miss, if his tail hook should miss the wire, or it should skip off the wire, the plane has to be ready to take off. The pilot has to be able to go wham, all the way forward and take off, or else he crashes on the deck. You don't need that disaster. Now, the same thing is played out on an FA-18 Hornet. Okay, imagine coming in at full power, what kind of skill and nerve this takes. Well, I wasn't on an FA-18. I was on a turboprop plane. It came in at a probably, I don't know, 120 knots. I don't know the exact speed, 80 to 120 knots. And it's called a controlled crash because you go from 100 and whatever knots to zero in about like 1-2 seconds or something like that when the tail hook hits. They said, you're going to hear it's going to sound like the bottom of the plane is falling out when you come down close to the deck because you're flying about a foot off the deck. And the tail hook is grabbing along, dragging along the bottom. And it sounds like pieces are falling off the plane, but don't be scared because the plane's not crashing. And also, when you take off, they said smoke is going to be coming up from the floorboards because whatever, I don't know where the smoke went. There was lots of smoke coming through, whatever. So the landing was nothing to me. I actually was laughing and had a great time. It was a great deal of fun. That was nothing. So I then spent the next 24 hours asking everyone, well, what's worse, landing or taking off? It was very interesting. People were saying, well, landing is worse than taking off. I got to tell you, the taking off was different. I didn't have a sense of a loss of control in the landing. I don't know why. Well, you're sitting backwards, number one, and since you're landing and the thrust takes you backwards, you're thrown into the seat rather than out of the seat, so I guess you don't feel it as much. Unfortunately, the seats are still backwards when you take off, which is exactly the wrong way for them to be because you're going to be thrust with your head down. So you're held in a four-point harness, but your head is not held by anything. Anyway, you're sitting on the deck, and it's very hot in there. It's not air-conditioned. It's a military plane, and the engines are revving and revving and revving and revving, and it's noisy, and your legs are crashed right up against the seat in front of you to make sure you don't, you know, kill yourself. Arms crossed, and then I don't know who they were, but they jump up and scream seconds before that it starts flashing, prepare for blah, 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 it's flat. And then the guys jump up, these huge guys screaming, you know, take off, take off, take off, you know, like that's blah, 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 and bang. So it's 1-2, you're going to 180 knots in 2 seconds, and then all of a sudden the strangest thing happens. You're in suspended animation hanging from your strap as the plane goes dead silent in the air and slightly dips below the deck of the carrier, and you think that the plane is like...
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Admittedly, we have the most incompetent, corrupt administration in history. Yes. But I believe that the founding fathers were so brilliant that they anticipated a day that an imposter like this would wind up in the White House. The entire Constitution was written to protect the people from Obama. My belief is that the entire Constitution was written foreseeing the day that an imposter communist would take over the country, the White House, and try to impose his will on the people with every trick in the book. But to couple with that, you have a complacent, a supine media like I've never seen. I watched Obama's press conference. I had to stop eating. I have never seen anything like it. One loaded laugh, one loaded question after another. And the last question was saved for some stooge from NPR who basically gets up and says, Mr. Obama, do you have any hope that the Republicans will be nice? Listen to clip 15.
Can you share with us why you have some hope that the talks that have been going on might actually produce an outcome?
I always have hope. Don't you remember my campaign?
You hear? You hear the schmucks? These are our press. This is the press, national press, sitting there. He makes a stupid, tepid joke, and right away they're in laughter like the principal came into a classroom. I never saw anything like this. Where is the press? When did this happen? Where did the hardened reporters go? When did they disappear? When were they replaced by these sad sacks laughing at a president's tepid jokes when they should be the ones pressing him on saying, wait a minute, tell us why you're pushing raising taxes and spending more when it's not worked in it didn't work in Eastern Europe. Why are you trying to push that model on the American economy? You think one person would ask that question? That's nonsense. What's not nonsense is identity theft. Someone stealing your credit cards and try to destroy your life? Don't be a victim. Call my advertiser, LifeLock, today. Call LifeLock now at 1-800-LOCK-485. You get 60 risk-free days just for Savage listeners. 1-800-562-5485. Write it down. Call now, 1-800-LOCK-485. It's hard for me to watch television at all anymore. I admit I watch too much television, but I can't watch the news at all. I can't even watch cable television news. You forget about it. I mean, even Fox, they do a fairly good job, but I can't even watch that. It is so cut and dry. There's no real emotion in it. There's no real gutsy opinion in it. It's all cut and dried. You know what I watch a lot on TV? I got to tell you. I watch movies. I admit it. Too many at night. I admit it. The clicker now has become like a second, third hand. Sorry. Can't help it. I'm entitled. Chinese food, Italian food, occasionally Indian food, and then the clicker. What can I do? I do ride the bike and go out on the boat, and I do look at the moon at night on a full moon night, and I do watch the birds, and I do know what a peregrine falcon looks like. But the fact of the matter is far too many screens in my life. The computer all day with the call screen is on my left side. I got a call screen that says, Tom from New York says Catholic saying. On the right side, I have the wires which show me all the websites and what's breaking, and then the dog is sleeping under the desk, and I leave here, I go home. I don't know how much time there is between now and when I watch television, but not honest to God, it's getting it. I'm addicted to screens, and I was a guy who resisted all of these things. I'm addicted now. I'm a total addict. I am a total addict of the screen. There's nothing I can do. But you know, you got to go with it. You know, as Aristotle Onassis said, if you're going to get raped, you may as well enjoy it. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I'm enjoying the internet more than ever. I don't feel guilty about it. Do you have internet guilt? Has anyone written that yet? Go steal my idea. Do any of you have internet guilt that you spend too much time on the computer, not enough time with your children? Or that you're spending more time on a computer than you are with your wife? Well, that you can understand. That's an old Henny Youngman joke. But the fact of the matter is, we're all addicted to the computer. If you have an IQ over 19, you're addicted to the computer. Talk radio is still dominant in terms of the world of political ideas in this country. I did it on this show. It was done nowhere else. We kept hearing talk radio is this, talk radio is that. It's only for old people. Talk radio is dead. Cable news is king. Internet is king. I don't say they don't have a powerful influence. You got to be a fool not to say so. At this stage, though, you'd have to admit, no matter how much of a doubting Thomas you are, that Michael Savage has rescued talk radio from the gallows. Talk Radio Network. an independent syndicator. I work with the best team in talk radio. They know me. They're like my friends, all the guys in the back room. It's unbelievable to me. This is a family. This is a team. We are the Yankees of talk radio. If anyone out there has been doubting whether talk radio still is powerful, let me tell you something. It is more powerful today than it ever has been in my 16-year career. Much more powerful today. More listeners than ever. More influence than ever. That's if you're in the inner ring. If you're in the inner ring, you have an audience that needs you and listens to you. And if you make sense, well, you're gonna make a lot of friends and a lot of unhappy people too. I wouldn't use the word enemies because we don't yet live in North Korea.
Savage.
And liftoff, the final liftoff of Atlantis on the shoulders of the space shuttle. America will continue the dream.
And it's the end of a dream. The Marxist president, Barack Hussein Obama, has ended the space shuttle. We were once dominant in space. It began with Russia beating us with Sputnik. I remember it when I was in college and what it did for science and engineering in this country. It revolutionized the United States of America. And we became leaders in space. And this era is now over because of one Marxist president. 10,000 jobs wiped out with the stroke of a communist pen. All this and more on the Savage Nation today. Obama killed the space program, not only ending America's dominance and turning it over to Russia and China, but he killed 10,000 jobs as well. And he got away with it. He got away with it because the compliant, do I have to say it? The vermin in the media. How many different ways do I have to say the compliant media? It was destroyed by Barack Obama. Remember on April 15, 2010, Obama announced that he was going to end NASA's current space exploration program, and he was going to hand billions of dollars over to private companies who were supposed to do this for the United States of America. What he did not tell you is that the soonest the privately built space shuttle can be ready is 2014. And in the interim, what are we going to do? What will Obama do in the meantime to get astronauts and cargo into space? Why, he's going to buy tickets on a Russian rocket. He is buying 6 seats each year on Russia's Soyuz spacecraft. Now, I want to ask you something. Do you think that the Russians are stupid? Do you think the Russians are going to actually charge you the price that they told Obama they would charge back in 2010 when he said he was ending NASA? Or do you think they might jack up the price since they own the rocket? And what about the secrecy of the mission? What secrecy? Our astronauts are like human cargo now. Sitting on a Russian spacecraft, they can hardly talk without being overheard. They'll be bugged. And of course, that gives Russia any advantage that they may want over our wonderful Chairman Obama, which is, of course, on purpose. Ladies and gentlemen, we want to go back to some of the archival audio from the president back at NASA in 2010, when he decided with the stroke of a pen to destroy NASA and to set us back decades, not years. Listen to clip 11 of Barack Obama last year.
Now, despite this, some have had harsh words for the decisions we've made, including some individuals who I've got enormous respect and admiration for. But what I hope is that everybody will take a look at what we are planning, consider the details of what we've laid out, and see the merits as I've described them. The bottom line is, nobody is more committed to manned spaceflight, to human exploration of space, than I am.
Okay, that was lie number one. In the next clip, 15, from the Kennedy Space Center from a year ago, the Marxist president lies about jobs. Listen.
Despite some reports to the contrary, my plan will add more than 2,500 jobs along the space coast in the next 2 years compared to the plan under the previous administration. This holds the promise of generating more than 10,000 jobs nationwide over the next few years. And many
liar,
of these jobs will
liar,
be created
right liar, now. Liar, 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 Das Kapital is on fire. When the space shuttle Atlantis returns to Earth, 2,000 Kennedy Space Center employees will be fired, bringing job losses from the shuttle program close to 10,000. I had to get this out of The Guardian in England. So far as I know, there's not one stooge newspaper in America. Not one stooge newspaper in America. Not one copy. Not one sheet, not one paragraph in America talking about the decimation of jobs in engineering and space technology that were conducted by this Marxist president. Did you hear what I just said to you? 10,000 jobs wiped out by Herr leader, your leader, Obama. I know you don't care about it. I know that the country is so stupid right now that all you care about is which actor is shtupping which actress. Which actress dropped her skirt on Sunset Boulevard? Which actor took steroids? I mean, it's a nightmare what's going on in this country. I can't blame Obama for that. The reason he's president is because you're stupid. The reason we have a president like this is because of your dumbness. The reason he can get away with wiping out NASA is because you know, it's not even the word stupid, is it right? There's a worse condition than idiocy or stupidity, and that is indifference. I believe Americans have become totally indifferent. They're like Nutty Putty. They can be molded in any shape. So today, 10,000 jobs wiped out by Obama. Oh, ho-hum. Ho-hum as long as you've got internet porn and whatever else it is that keeps you going. Baseball game? Don't even get me started with that idiocy. As Atlantis logo reflects, that's the name of the space shuttle Atlantis, by the way. Atlantis. It's Omega on the logo. The last letter of the Greek alphabet. You know what that is, don't you? Greek alphabet, Omega. It's the end of the line. The last flight for NASA's 30-year space shuttle program. After 293 days in space, Atlantis will log 12 more and then call it quits. Today, with a dramatic roar and a rumble, Atlantis left 2.5 minutes late. The skies cleared Friday in Florida, down in Florida, and it launched. Atlantis's next life will be as a museum artifact at the Kennedy Space Center Visitors Complex. That summarizes the space program under Obama. A museum artifact. The U.S. dollar may as well go into a museum artifact. Just as the spacecraft will have circled the planet at least 4,648 times, the U.S. dollar will have circled the Earth sufficient times to wind up in a museum. NASA Control Tower said before liftoff, "We are closing a chapter on a journey that never ends." I doubt that that's true. The fact of the matter is, it is over. We are now passengers on Russian spacecrafts. 10,000 jobs lost. From the Wright brothers to Barack Obama in the blink of an eye. Wisconsin, Jerry, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, I'd just like to say we don't, as a nation, know how to play poker. They're going to ask for more.
Of course they will. Let's say they said that it was $1 million a seat. It'll be $10 million a seat by the time we get on it.
Yeah, but Boehner's doing nothing more with the Republican Party with a debt limit. I mean, they don't...
Well, no, they're ready to negotiate with the Marxist tyrant. They're ready to settle. They're ready to settle with the Marxist tyrant.
You can't negotiate.
Well, they are negotiating. They are.
Yeah.
You know, there's not much more I can say right now. 1-800-449-8255. If you'd like to see who our president really is, go to michaelsavage.com. We found this superb archival photo of him in his early years in full bloom in front of a blackboard. You can see the curled lip, the hateful eyes. You could see the real Barack Obama as opposed to the one they polished up for the run for the presidency. I don't know how we got this picture. But my headline is, our president in his early days, D-A-Z-E. That's all. James in New York, W-O-R, go ahead, please.
Yes, Savage, thank you for taking my call. Listen, I agree with you. I think that if we don't go into space, it's going to take away the impetus that could be given to the United States. And it's ironic that you mentioned Sputnik, because when they came back, when the Russians came back, photos came back, these guys had photos of Mars. Can you believe in 1957 they had photos of Mars, and we already compete with them back then? And now we're rolling over. They had photos of the face on Mars. And now we roll over. We have no agenda.
Well, what do you mean we roll over? A communist president destroyed our space shuttle program. I didn't roll over. Did you get a chance to discuss it with your congressman or your senator?
No.
No. A Marxist tyrant ended it with a stroke of a pen. He got away with it. It's an impeachable offense.
Savage, I think it's ironic that also the last shuttle is called Atlantis, as if it's, you know, the lost world. We're sinking into the Atlantic, like like Plato talks about. It's a lost empire that just sinks down.
That's right. And the logo on the Atlantis space shuttle today was Omega, the last letter of the Greek alphabet. Is that writing the last chapter in American history? Has Obama signed the last chapter, signed off on the last paragraph of American, let us say, dominance on the world stage?
You know, it could very well be, just like it has in the Bible.
Yeah, it could very well be. But let his wife go on another junket to Africa with the children and not ask one question about, wait a minute, what is a mother-in-law doing in the White House? Who's paying for the travel with the children? What in the world is this? Let them eat cake. What can I tell you? I wrote about it in Trickle Up Poverty. I devoted a whole chapter to how he was gutting the military. Do you know that our Navy will now be reduced to the smallest number of ships since World War I? You say, well, we don't need ships. Well, we don't need anything. All we need is night basketball and welfare, right? And road jobs for Nancy Pelosi. All you need is construction projects for Nancy Pelosi. That's all. That's all that's needed is construction jobs for Nancy Pelosi, night basketball, and more welfare. And, of course, health care for 26-year-olds so they can stay at home sleeping till 3 o'clock in the afternoon with a hairnet on and then go out to their nightclub at night. There's an awful lot going on. I don't know how you don't know it. I don't know how you don't see it. Take me out at the ball game. Take me out at the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. Why, he's a nice young man. All those right-wingers are being mean because they're racist. They don't like Obama, not because he's doing anything wrong. Why, he's doing everything right. It's just that all of those right-wingers are racist. They don't have legitimate criticism of that nice young man. Why, it's such a nice young family. Why, look at those nice young daughters of his. Why, they're shown and paraded around on a regular basis, even though at one point he said the children should be, the families of a president should be off limits. Why, now he uses them daily. Take me out to the ball game. I'll be right back.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Playing Hawaiian music because, first of all, I'd like to be there right now, truthfully. But I'm going to wait it out. Great place. It's a great place. Great. I lived there for a number of years, you know. You know what it's like for a kid from New York to go, like, to wind up in Hawaii? I'd never been in a place like that. It was unbelievable. It was like walking into, a heaven itself. So anyway, to make a long story short, we're talking about a turn it off now, a long time ago. You know, when you land in heaven, you think you can do anything, and you have hubris. Hubris is a sense of confidence that only children and the mad have and can understand. But when a grown-up has hubris, it becomes very dangerous, and in my case, that was true. So you get to the islands, and it's a magical time. You never saw sunsets like this. They can break your heart. When you see plumeria blossoms lying on the, you know, I used to bicycle up to the university. I would see plumeria blossoms lying on the sidewalk. I would stop the bicycle and pick up the plumeria blossoms and look at them and smell them. And I'd never seen anything like this. Sure, I had seen rose petals on the fence in the Bronx when I was a little kid. They were soft and beautiful. But this was something unique. The scent was unlike anything I had ever experienced. And so you see these sunsets and these sunrises and all of these things that you have never seen, and birds in the jungles in the back of the rainforest that you never saw or heard before. And you start to get tuned into your own body in a way you've never been tuned in. If you've never lived in the tropics and it's the first time, and you start shedding clothing and shoes and leather and you put it all away, and now you're in flip-flops and then you're in shorts, and all of a sudden at night the breeze comes through your sleeves and you start to become alive in a new way, and you go in the warm water. So you start to feel like the original man. And you buy a sailboat. It's the first thing you do. And so I bought a sloop-rigged boat. She was not catch-rigged. I was mistaken. I remember now. Tirangi was a sloop-rigged sailing vessel about 22 feet long. And it was made of white oak primarily. And it had been built in Oregon and sailed out by somebody else to Hawaii. I bought it for nothing, you know, next to nothing. She was in perfect shape and no engine, as I said. So I buy this boat. I put it into the Alawai Yacht Harbor. And that's where I kept it. And, you know, most people who own boats mainly use them to drink on and hang out. And it's as good a thing to do as any. But I was foolish enough to actually want to sail the boat, even though I knew nothing about sailing. And I took it out without an engine. I knew it was pretty easy to get out because the wind was prevailing out of the yacht harbor. And I said, wow, this is great. And so I, you know, with a few friends, I was on a boat alone. They just cast me off, released the lines, pushed me backwards. And there we go, down the Alawai Channel, out into the channel and out into the ocean. I was zipping along with the sail out, and I was zipping along out onto sea. And there I was. I said, this is super. I'm really enjoying myself. Then I realized I didn't know how to get back. I said, how do I turn this thing around if the wind is blowing out? Well, I didn't know how. And I said, well, I better figure this out, because if this keeps up for a while, I'll soon be out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and there'll be no way back at all. I had no flares, no radio, no engine. All I had was confidence that was bordering on the insane. The first thing I did was I resorted to common sense, and I dropped the sails, because that, of course, would cut the motion of the boat. I dropped the sails, and using the tiller, I turned the boat around, you know, flip-flop, flip-flop, until I got the boat pointing back towards the land. And then I figured if the wind is blowing against me, there must be a way to go into a prevailing wind and still move against it. I've seen other people do it. And little by little, and lo and behold, I was able to, luckily, I don't know whether it was current or God's hand itself pushed me back into the harbor, but I learned quickly that sailing is not for the amateur. That's all there was to it. So those days are over. But she was my first boat. I don't have a life ring from Tarangi because I didn't even have a life ring. I don't even think I had a life preserver. You know, those were the age. That was an age when people had total, like, madness about what they could do and accomplish in the late 60s. But now I drive a power boat, and it has all sorts of safety equipment on it. Sure, not enough as I should have. But I like power boats a lot better because they're easier to get out. I can get this thing out of the way. It's 45 feet, twin diesels, 19 tons, unladen with fuel and water, and I can go out on it alone and come back on it alone in almost any wind. And that's the good part. You can get out in 12, 15 minutes, and there it is. It's just you and the birds and the water and the land, and that's it. And that's what I go out for now, is just to look at the water and look at the birds and look at the landforms, mainly, and the seals I like. And I can name every bird on the bay. More or less, I know every bird on the bay as a species. Not by name, not like, how you doing, howdy. I don't mean that. Species-wise, I've come to understand that every animal has a personality. Isn't this strange? It's not that the PETA folks are correct. I still eat animals. But they all have a personality when you get to know them. And they all want to live. Dad taught me that everything wants to live. That's how he taught me to respect human life. He said, you'll notice that a cat wants to live, a dog wants to live, a rat wants to live, a mouse wants to live, a bird wants to live. And he had learned that when he had accidentally shot a bird as a kid. Remember, this is odd to a country boy listening to the show. It sounds very weak. But remember, I'm a New York City boy. And to us, it's a different experience than it is to you guys. I respect your ability to hunt for your food. But every animal actually has a personality when you get to know that animal. They're all different. Just as we're all different, every human is unique and like a snowflake. Well, guess what? So are animals. They're all unique. It's amazing when you come to understand that.
Savage.
Did I ever tell you about One-Armed Frank? You haven't heard the One-Armed Frank story. Do I have a moment? My father, I told you, was an antique dealer. May he rest in peace. So we would come home from... Well, he had a guy who came in with one arm. I don't know how the guy became one arm. But he, you know, you didn't know a lot of people with one arms in those days. Even today, they have a... I guess you don't know one-arm people. Today, they have a fake arm. But he had the arm sewed up, you know, in a suit. So, all right, so you accept him. His name, though, was One-Armed Frank. Because nobody hid reality in those days. Today it's like, oh, yeah, he's normal. He's just like a... In those days, it was One-Armed Frank. Today it's like, oh, he's better than normal, man. He's special. Like, if you have one arm, you're better than a guy with two arms today. You know what I mean? If you have no arms and no legs, you're Superman in the politically correct world of today. But in those days, if you were missing an arm, that's what you would name, One-Armed Frank. Whatever your anomaly was, that was your name. It made it easier for the average person to remember everybody. So One-Armed Frank was a very sweet guy, but a breath on him. Now, I want to tell you, there are bad breaths, then there are very bad breaths, then there are medicinal problems. This had to be solved with a medicine that hasn't been invented yet. It was winter time, and once in a while, my old man would drive one-armed Frank home, and I'd get stuck in the back, and one-armed Frank would get shotgun. Now, I want to tell you something. It could be minus 4 degrees in New York. You had a ride with all the windows open. Did you ever have a person like this, Greg? I'm serious, where it's medicinally like a medical problem, where he says anything, and the car fills with a noxious fume. Where you don't know what to do. You know, are we going past the Trun's meat factory? No, we're not in Williamsburg. Did we run over a small furry creature that got caught in the muffler and shot up through the floorboard? Did I step on something on the way? No, it's Frank talking.
Savage.
I said this to me, a professor back in 1970. He said, you know, you're the only person I've ever met. He said, it's astonishing that you can function. He says, you have no barrier between your conscious and your subconscious. You actually function with both at once. So I said, and? So? What's wrong with that? In other words, I've plumbed my depth sufficiently through self-analysis to know who I am, and I'm not ashamed of it. What do I got to hide? I'm not like most people. Well, what's there to hide? When everything I see isn't so pretty. But that's life, you know. Out of the muck, a lotus will grow. We all come from the muck, and we all go back to the muck. We come from the muck. We go back to the muck. What more do you need to know? None of us are demigods. None of us are God. Once you understand that we arise from a smelly ether called the swamp of life, and that is what we go back to, the rest is very easy. Then you stop worrying about if you have an extra little flab on your stomach and a gray hair and a mole on your face. And you suddenly accept yourself for what you are. Then you can wear an undershirt and look at yourself in the mirror and say, that's it, thank God I'm alive. And I got two legs and two arms and two lungs and a beating heart. What more do I need? I'm going to look like a bicycle rider who takes cocaine? Oh, God, what am I talking about? Why are you listening to me? I'm going up and down the scale here. I'm playing the scales for you on the Savage Nation. No, I'm a little upset because I opened a letter just now, a personal letter. I shouldn't have done it during the show. I got all my mail, and I opened one from a relative. It's a shocker. It's a picture of my late father from a year before he died. Photo of daddy enclosed. Your mother kept it in her bag till she died. No, I never saw this picture. He looked healthy. He shouldn't have died this young. I'm older than he was, and he died. It's eerie. Yeah, I thank God Oscar the cat is in here. He's liable to curl up next to me, and it will be all be all over. He's in better shape than I am. Are you kidding me? And he died anyway? Not a gray hair on his head. And thin? I put on weight. I got gray hair, and I'm still kicking. Go figure it out. You know how many guys died in their 30s that I knew who were runners? Huffing and puffing with watches, and they'd vitamin every minute they looked at their watch. They wouldn't touch this, and they ate perfect. They dropped dead like flies. I don't say don't exercise, but no man is made to run like an Ethiopian bee picker day and night. You're not living in Ethiopia at 12,000 feet. That's why they win these races everywhere. That's they run at high altitudes. You don't. Every year's a few blowouts here with the San Francisco, what do they call it? Marathon, the marathon. Every year they got someone dropping dead before the finish line. If you want to run, go run. Enjoy yourself. This too shall pass. I have a whole different theory of exercise at a certain point in your life. Now, remember, I wrote the book on nutrition, and I also exercise moderately, but the key word is moderately. This excessive, like you're on a treadmill, heart attackville. It's worse than sitting in front of a television and eating Doritos. And I'm telling you, no human being has made the... You ever see old men running like that? It's insanity, total insanity. Show me in nature where a man runs like that after the age of 40, unless he's being chased by a predator who wants to burn his house down. Nobody runs like that if they don't have to.
The President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition. They're teaching our kids how to make healthier choices about what they eat, and they're inspiring young people across the country and start getting fit. Members of the council will be encouraging military kids and all kids in families to meet a new challenge we created last year. It's called the President's Active Lifestyle Award, or PALA is how we call it for short. The idea here is very simple. If kids do an hour of physical activity a day, 5 days a week for 6 weeks, they get an award from who other than the man in the Oval Office, the President of the United States. What more could you want as a kid or from the President?
Did you hear that? And it's organizations like the AARP who control these leftist politicians. AMAC is fighting back. The Association of Mature American Citizens. Your membership can help stop the left wing. Call 800-255-4199. 800-255-4199 or go to AmericaIsRising.com. 800-255-4199. AmericaIsRising.com. Our president, all our MBA-like leaders, they all run. They're in perfect shape and they can't think. Stop with the sobriety, have a drink, and sit in the bathtub with a cigar. Maybe you can save the country. You'll have some insights. Like take the handcuffs off the men, number one, and tell the liberals to go to hell, number two. That might save America. I think I'll have a pizza for dinner tonight and beer. Nah, I think tonight I'm going to drive into the city. I'm not in the city. I'm not in San Francisco now. I'm out in the suburban location, one of my Arafatian houses. I have many locations. I don't know where I'm going to be the next night. That way, if anyone, they don't know where I'm going to, because I don't know where I'm going to broadcast from or where I'm going to sleep. I have several locations. I have to. That's what the liberals are today. I have to watch out for them because they're all psychopaths. Every last one of them belongs in a mental hospital. Or in a straitjacket. That's all. Forget it. I don't want to go into bashing liberals. It's been done too often. And I did it better than anybody else. Oh, let's move on. San Fran. What? Someone from England sent me a new one. I use San Francisco, San Francisco. San Fran. She called us something else. A friend from somewhere. A long email. San Fran. I can't remember why I bring it up. Going back to the Lower East Side of New York. Dad owns a small antiques mart. Little old Michael's cleaning bronzes in the back, and there's Louis the Bum from the Bowery, who in those days, he was a drunk. He wasn't a bum. He worked. Dad would have him in on the weekends, and he'd clean the bronzes and whatever he did down there. I loved Louis. Louis was a great guy. But now you got to understand, this guy was a stoned alcoholic of the old school. Skinny like a rail. White guy, skinny like a rail, smoked like unfiltered cigarettes. But one of the nicest guys on earth. He wears the rubber apron. He's cleaning downstairs, does the bronzes. Then, of course, I took over because Dad wanted cheap child labor, and where else are you going to get it from his son, you know? So I'm doing the thing. So I got to know Louis over the years, and he taught me various things. Like once we had Louis over to the house. I'll never forget it. I was so proud that my father took this guy who I liked all the way out to Queens and invited him to dinner. I don't know what came over. Maybe it was Thanksgiving or whatever. And Louis had dinner with us at the table, and the guy was surprisingly erudite, and he knew things. And like after dinner, we did games, and Louis the drunk showed me how to bend nails. He showed me mind over matter. He took a nail and he showed me that if you put your fingers, blah blah blah, and put your mind on it and keep up the pressure, the nail would bend. I was shocked because I was a skinny kid with little hands, and I bent the nail. And he taught me mind over matter, but it was all molecular because you put the heat and the pressure, blah blah blah, eventually that nail is going to bend. But I learned in life it's the same thing. It's all willpower. Okay, now there's another element to the story. So Louis is this kind of guy, interesting, but an alcoholic, and this and that. Years go by. He lives alone in Williamsburg. In those days, Williamsburg was like a slum, zero, you know, oilcloth city, leftover apartments from the last century. No one wanted to be there but the poor. So he lives there alone. He's very lonely. He gets a monkey. He wants a monkey. Now, out of the world, nobody in those days had a monkey. Dogs, yes. Cats, yes. No. Who had a monkey in those days? Louis gets a monkey. But Louis don't just get a spider monkey, one of the skinny little monkeys. Louis gets a woolly monkey. Now, woolly monkeys are already strong. They got a chest on them. They got strong hands. And Louis's in love with this monkey. For a couple of months, they're inseparable. Wherever he goes, There's the monkey, and the monkey's on his shoulder, and where he's cleaning, and he's happy. Now, Louis was the kind of guy that if he went to a bar in the Lower East Side, I remember the name to this day, named Hamill and Corn, whatever money he made for my father, he'd take 2 minutes later, he'd be in the bar, and he'd throw money in a jukebox, and he would whistle and sing, and he'd buy everyone drinks till he was broke. He'd stumble out in the street. He would get hit by a car, sleep on a barrel. He didn't care. He lived for the booze, and that was it, but he had a heart of gold. So Louis gets the monkey, finally has someone to fill his empty nights, and as I say, they were inseparable. Well, as time went on, we get a call. Louis's in the hospital. He's dying. What? The monkey went crazy in his apartment, attacked him, and almost ripped him to pieces. And he suffered for 6 months in the hospital. I don't know which hospital. Probably Bellevue, because that's where they all wound up. And the monkey went at him in love. You don't know what a monkey's like when it goes crazy. You try to stop an enraged monkey without a weapon. He ripped his neck. He ripped his face. He ripped his arms. He ripped his leg. He ripped his crotch. He ripped his behind. Louis was ripped up pretty bad. And eventually, Louis knew that the instincts had to kick in. It was him or the monkey. And he decided it was better him than the monkey. He didn't consult a liberal book on how to deal with a crazed monkey. He just fought with it and killed it. I think that's what the bottom line is here. But the point is that even a lonely drunk needs companionship at night. In his case, he found the monkey. It was probably the right thing for him to do. So right now you could see that Louis was a pioneer in a way, in a sense that he understood that monkeys were dangerous long before they did in India when they turned him into a sacred animal. And that's the Louis and the monkey story on the Savage Nation. You got to admit it wasn't bad. It's nicely entertaining. And that's it. That's the story. The bottom line is, don't get a monkey as a pet. They're